In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'm joined by Jossie. He is a David Bowie-influenced glam rocker based in Nashville, Tennessee. His latest album is Here Comes the Good Part, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Cheap High. We'll give a listen to a portion of that now, followed by our chat on your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. With your coolest conversations, and today finds me chatting with Jossie, the David Bowie inspired glam rocker whose fourth album Here Comes the Good Part is home to our coolest song in the world this week, Cheap High. Hello Jossie, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing pretty excellent, very happy to have you on the line with me here. You know, I'm from Georgia originally, grew up around the Atlanta area, and I hear that you live in Nashville. Is that where you are right now?
Yes, I'm in Nashville right now, but I did not grow up in Georgia. I grew up in West Virginia.
Right, and where in West Virginia did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town called Hinton, West Virginia, which is kind of a little railroad town in the southern part of the state, but a beautiful area, lots of mountains and rivers. So I grew up on a farm there in a holler.
A farm in a holler. So about how far is that from like Charleston?
It's about 2 hours from there, so not too far.
2 hours from there. So it's this little town there. It was a farm?
Yeah. My parents moved there in the 70s to kind of live off the land. They were kind of back to the land movement. So, big garden. My dad even worked the farm with a mule, you know, using kind of primitive farming techniques. And it's a beautiful holler. It's like 200 and some acres, but mostly woods.
And was it fairly isolated there or not?
Oh, yeah. Quite isolated there, yeah.
Did you guys keep yourselves entertained with playing music? Do either your parents play music?
My parents actually don't play music, but I was lucky in that they had a fabulous record collection. And, I grew up listening to just tons of great music. I was hugely into the Beatles when I was a kid, but also Bob Marley and African music and early jazz, like Cab Calloway records, and early blues. My dad actually had an incredible collection of 78 blues records. I mean, including things by like Blind Boy Fuller and Bo Carter and just really rare, amazing records. So I was just very lucky in that I kind of was exposed to that from a super early age. And I got a guitar when I was 6 and just started, you know, playing along with those records and writing my own songs and just was fascinated by it really early on and kind of just took to it.
Well, you said you got a guitar when you were 6. Why did you get a guitar? What spurred your parents or someone to give you a guitar when you were 6?
I know I wanted one. I think it was at that point, I feel like it was the Beatles. I loved the Beatles. And actually, before I got a guitar, I used to set up pots and pans in our kitchen and I would use like chopsticks and would play drums along with the Beatles when I was about four. So drums was like my, I guess, my first instrument. I don't know. I remember, I mean, it was, I think it was a $15 guitar at a flea market that they got me, just a little acoustic guitar. I just immediately, I mean, there's still videos of me just like, I would, you know, have my parents come in the living room and just like, you know, perform and just make stuff up. So yeah, I think I was just drawn to it.
Okay. So although thinking of the Beatles, you were first Ringo before you moved to sort of an amalgamation of,
And then pretty quickly after that, it was the Stones. The Stones kind of took over. I had that Get Your Ya-Ya's Out live record and, something about that, like the thrill, like the crowd and just the live element really, really captivated me. So I remember playing along with that, just like cranking it in my living room, playing along with that a lot.
Well, that, when you got that record though, was that a record that you purchased your own, or was that something that you discovered in your parents' collection?
That was something I discovered in my parents' collection. And actually, you know, that one could, and I remember it was a cassette tape. It could have been, so we had a part of the equation is that there was a Russian family that had moved from St. Petersburg to the house next door. There were two houses in the holler. And they moved into the other one and, they were, you know, very highly educated and were part of a whole underground Russian rock and roll scene, in St. Petersburg. And so they brought also a huge record collection and also this whole kind of, especially the British invasion rock and roll and glam rock. That was kind of where a lot of that came from. And so that was kind of, even though my parents had a great record collection, there was also this, you know, kind of that whole other influence, as well. And so that tape actually may have been given to me by them. I can't remember. But yeah, I know it was, you know, I didn't go out and really buy a record until I was probably, you know, a little old, like in my teens. I think I remember buying some Led Zeppelin records and a White Stripes. I think probably, yeah, the fourth White Stripes record.
Wow. Okay. So since you start, you know, messing around with a guitar when you're like six, did you ever take like guitar lessons?
I did. I did take some lessons, probably starting around, I guess when I was around eight or nine, I think. I think something around that. With like a local jazz guitar player. And I mostly, I remember bringing in, I mean, I think I remember when I was eight, I think I brought in actually a Rolling Stones tape and was like, I want to learn the riff to Jumpin' Jack Flash. So I remember that was like the first riff I ever learned. I remember, yeah, practicing that a lot. So I would, you know, bring in a lot of stuff that I wanted to learn. So I brought in a lot of like Jimi Hendrix and all these, you know, guitar riffs that I was like, man, I can't figure out how to, like, I want to learn. And he would show me how to play them. And then, you know, I would go home and just practice and play and just explore. And it kind of got to a point when I was more like 13 that I kind of could figure stuff out on my own. So then I kind of stopped taking lessons or, you know, would take them very occasionally. But I was kind of, once I could listen to a record and learn it, then I was just trying to learn everything. And that was also the same time I discovered Led Zeppelin, which just sort of blew open, you know, my whole imagination of what was possible on guitar. Because it was like all the stuff that I was into, but it was just dialed up to 11, you know, the drumming, the singing, the bass playing, the guitar. It was just like, there was like the best band I'd ever, and I had somehow never heard them until I was 13. My dad got me a live Led Zeppelin CD for Christmas. And it just, that became, at that point, like from then for about 4 years until I was about 17, I just devoured Led Zeppelin every day. I would play along with them. I had that live DVD and I would put that on and play along with it just about every single day I got home from school.
You got home from school, so you were not homeschooled. You went to a public school, to a high school, public high school?
I did go to a public high school, and I was an alien there.
I was going to say, just being concentrated with doing all the rock music stuff, you must have seemed like a weirdo. So how did you deal with all that?
It was really rough for me. It was very rough. There were several years. I mean, middle school and high school, up until about 11th, 12th grade, it was extremely rough for me. It was felt like a very hostile environment. I was just, you know, because in that at that time, and probably still now, but you know, that culture really rewarded conformity. You know, like the people that did well in that environment all were the same and conformed. And I was so different in multiple ways, you know? And so, and you were punished for that. I mean, I was, you know, a freak to them. And so I, you know, there were a few years where I tried to like kind of fit in, and I would sort of like dress to just kind of try and blend in. And then when I would get home, I would like put on, you know, all my, like I was living this sort of double life trying to survive at school. It was, and it was a very violent high school. So it was like, it was tough for me for sure. And my guitar was kind of the only way I kind of got out of it was, you know, towards the end of high school, like being, you know, really good. I was like the kid that was really good at guitar. So that kind of protected me a little bit at that point from, you know, cause yeah, there was, it was rough.
Well, did you play in any bands in high school?
I played like at the talent show in my high school, but I did have a band when I was 15, but it was one kid who had just graduated high school. So he was sort of out of the scene. And then the other kid was a childhood friend of mine who lived like an hour away, like 45 minutes away. So he went to a different school and he was a year younger than me, and he's an amazing drummer, and we grew up together. So yeah, when I was 15, we had a trio, and we did tons of Led Zeppelin stuff. And we played at like, I remember a homecoming dance, and not at my high school, but at a different high school. And that was kind of my first, you know, that was like the first like rush of adrenaline of like performing and people like going crazy. And it was like, it just was this incredible feeling that I remember being like, man, I want that again and again and again. And we played, you know, some local festivals, and it was, we were pretty good for being, you know, 15-year-olds. But it was definitely, it kind of solidified that, like, you know, I'm good at this. I feel natural doing it, and people seem to respond to it. So
you've got this, because of your parents, this is really cool and broad and deep, music collection. You're got this sort of background going on, and then, you start playing guitar, and you can kind of use music as a way to sort of deal with the stresses of school. And then you'd actually start performing. So this seems like a continuum sort of directing you towards, you know, what you're doing now. But the question is, was there ever any one moment or was there ever any epiphany or sort of realization like, no, this, I know what I'm doing now. This is what I'm going after going forward. Or is it more like this continuum?
I think it's more of a continuum. I mean, you know, because I mean, I've been on this, you know, I mean, I've really been on this path since I was 4 years, since the first time I heard music as like a literal baby, you know, I mean, it's kind of been, it's the only thing that has, you know, cause I've gone in through many different, I mean, I could have done so many things. I've been interested in so many things, but music was the one that kind of just I never got bored in any way. Cause so I went, you know, cause I've studied, you know, a lot of acoustic blues music and finger style open tunings and, you know, which are, you know, playing, you know, the finger picking and all of that is, you know, they're almost completely different instruments aside from electric guitar and drums and then production and composition and harmony. And, you know, I mean, and writing for strings. I mean, it's just such an endless world of possibilities. And so, I mean, there were many epiphanies that kind of shaped it. I mean, like that one performing at 15 was one of like, you know, I want to do this. But I remember the White Stripes album Elephant being an epiphany because up until that point, because I think of how isolated I was in West Virginia, you know, it felt like me and my like three friends were the only people that listened to Led Zeppelin, were the only people that still listened to T-Rex record. Like nobody, it felt like, because, you know, we were in a holler in West Virginia, we, you know, I mean, obviously people were still listening to that all over the world, but we felt like from our perspective, it was like nobody, like you can't have a career being a rock star anymore. There aren't any, like, it's like, it's over. Like that was, so I was kind of like, I don't know what kind of career I'm going to have in music. Cause you know, I don't know. I mean, this is what, you know, like this is my idea of what it would look like. And that doesn't seem to be possible. And I remember the White Stripes being like the first band that came out that was like, wow, this is a modern band doing real rock and roll. I mean, this is the real stuff. And that kind of was like, man, well, okay, if they're doing, if they can do that, then I might be able to do it, you know?
You're talking about, you know, studying music and becoming familiar with different techniques and so forth. And you went to the Berklee School of Music. So you finish high school? And how do you get there? Do you have to like audition for that, or what was your interest in going there?
Yeah, well, it was kind of, you know, I wanted to do music and I didn't know how to do it. And I went to a festival and there was this like unbelievable cello player. He was actually playing in a bluegrass band. He was a brilliant. He's still, his name's Rashad. He's a genius and also kind of insane, as many geniuses are. But he was playing cello like I had never heard it before. And I went and talked to him a bit, and he told me, yeah, he was on a full scholarship to Berkeley. And I'd never heard of Berkeley. And I looked it up and it was like, you know, it was a school where you could study music and did, because every school I looked at that point was all, you had to study classical guitar. And that was like one, you know, kind of the one avenue that I had not gone down. And it was like, I don't really want to, you know, go down this whole other path. I've already gone down many, many different musical paths. I don't think I want to do like classical. So Berkeley was like a way to go learn music, you know, learn, you know, especially jazz, but also contemporary music and all these different things. And it was just, it kind of, and it was in Boston. It was out of West Virginia, far away. It was like a whole new world. And it, you know, it was very prestigious too. It was like, okay, this is where the best goes. So I was like, man, that was it. So I started, because I didn't know how to read music at that point. So I taught myself how to read music and sight reading on guitar and worked on harmony. And I flew up there in a winter snowstorm. I remember I got stranded in Baltimore and I ended up like hitching a ride in a car because to get to my audition, because I would have missed it if I'd had to get on another flight. So it was, you know, like it's a total adventure, you know.
Well, what did you do for the audition?
I actually played a Tommy Emmanuel piece. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a brilliant, brilliant. He's like one of the best guitar players in the world, brilliant acoustic guitar player. And it was a very like fast piece that used all these different hybrid picking techniques. You know, it was just something that was like, you know, basically I can play the guitar really good. You know, it was one of those sort of pieces. And then, you know, there was like, they had me play a blues, which I was very familiar with. And, you know, soloing over blues. And then there was sight reading, which was the most nerve wracking part. Cause you know, sight reading for any guitarist is just always you're generally not their biggest skill set. At least sight reading like notes, I could sight read, you know, chord changes very, very well. And then there were things like where you would have to, they would like play a line and you would have to just play it back by ear. Which, you know, from learning records, you know, from learning stuff off records, I did pretty good. And, I got in, I got a little bit of scholarship, not very much, but I got in and I was, you know, super thrilled. And I was like, packed my bags and got out of West Virginia and was in downtown Boston in a few months.
How long were you at Berkeley?
I was there 4 years. I did the whole thing. I did the first, you know, and the thing about Berkeley is most people drop out after 2 years, which honestly, you know, it does make sense, because the first 2 years is where you really get the, you know, that turns you, first 2 years are like boot camp, you know, it turns you, you're in a musician. For 2 years at Berkeley, it's like now you're a musician. And then the second 2 years are more like specialized. But I had a band there. I had kind of my second band. So I was playing around Boston in like little club.
What was the band called?
It was called The Talkies. And it was just a two-piece like garage psych band, and it was kind of a way for me to sort of, you know, the two-piece part of it allowed me to kind of take all these different guitar techniques and stuff I was doing, kind of, you know, it was very improvisational, and it was just kind of, you know, some of my early songs exploring songwriting and different things. But you know, we still had a, you know, a little underground cult following, and it was, you know, it was just part, another step in the evolution. I think I could tell that it wasn't going to be like the band, but it was an important part of my kind of growth as a songwriter.
Well, so that was there in Boston. And at some point before you wound up in Nashville, were you out here in Los Angeles?
No, I was never. I mean, I did go to LA to record. I was actually on a record with some fellow Berkeley students. A friend that I met there, we made a record in Joshua Tree, actually, in like 2016, right before I moved to Nashville. But no, I was never living in LA. That was really my only time out there.
Well, what took you down to, what got you into Nashville then?
I did a session in Nashville with also another Berkeley, you know, that was one of the great things about Berkeley, was just the other students, you know, you're meeting all these talented, interesting musicians from all over the country. And I got asked to play guitar on a session in Nashville and came down, and it felt so accessible. You know, it was cheap to live here at the time. It just felt like a small town, but where most of the people are musicians. It was like a small town, but like everybody's a musician, everyone's in the industry, whether it's producers or songwriters. So it just, compared to New York or LA, it was kind of offered the same amount of resources, but it was much smaller and easier to access.
Oh, I was just going to say, a thing I love about Nashville is that, just reinforcing what you're saying, that there's, if you haven't been there before, there's an assumption that the city is actually much bigger than it is. And you get there and it's like, it's actually, it is a city, but it's not some sprawling sort of metropolis, that's just so expansive. And it's, as you say, it's very music oriented and a very, very lovely part of the state, I have to say as well. Very green and lovely there in Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, it really, it is. It is smaller than you think. And I mean, it's growing, at an insane rate. So it's getting bigger and bigger all the time, but it's still compared to New York City, it just felt like I could come here and, make some things happen. Whereas like in New York, I feel like I would have just been trying to survive,
Well, let me ask you this then. All right. So a lot of what is, the press publicity about you, is the glam influence things you've got going on through your music. And you mentioned you guys, being in high school and sort of feeling sort of freakish. Nobody else in the world is listening to T-Rex. No, you're sort of this isolation to this music that empowers you and inspires you. So, well, what is the connection here with Bowie, right? What is it? What is it about? Because you haven't, his name hasn't come up here. You seem to have a kind of a connection to this Ziggy Stardust sort of era. Well, what is it about Bowie?
Well, Bowie, I could have easily said Bowie when I said T-Rex earlier. He was a big part of that. And that really came from that Ruskin family. They were huge Bowie fans, and they really understood, because in Russia, they were studying the lyrics and kind of, it was so, music was so precious there that if you smuggled in, because those records were illegal, so if you smuggled in a Bowie record, Soviet record, they studied the lyrics and the concepts and the ideas. And so when I was, hanging out with them and we were talking about it and they were showing me this stuff, I was just kind of getting the whole artistic concept of what he was doing. And when I was younger, they were huge Bowie heads and I listened to a lot. I liked it, but I was, I was still a little more guitar oriented. So I was really like, I was a little more into like the Zeppelin riffs and stuff. And I didn't, Bowie went a little bit over my head initially. And so when I was more like 18, 20, and I was at Berkeley and I was really getting, that's when I was kind of, I had the guitar was sort of, now I wanted to write songs. I wanted to build kind of more of, an artistic, like kind of take it in some other directions and songwriting. And that was kind of when I kind of was, man, I want to listen to some Bowie. And I remember, listening to, some of that early Bowie stuff again that I had listened to so much growing up, but then listening to it again and just understanding it on such a deeper level and just realizing what a genius and how brilliant and interesting and the world building aspect of it just like really captured my attention. And it was just like, man, this is a way, I can take all of the things that I was interested in growing up. Cause I was really into the stories, I was always making up stories and making up characters. And that was just, I was the only child. So I just, I was the only child on this farm. So I was always kind of creating these scenarios and characters. So that element of glam rock really, really, kind of spoke to me and was just, it fascinated me. And I thought, that's just kind of the ultimate, it's got the guitarist, it's got the great music, but it also has this character and these concepts that are alluring and elusive and transportive. And so that was kind of when it came time for me to start writing songs, it just kind of, somehow my writing was just kind of in that vein and it just kind of made sense to, as a way to combine these various elements. Cause that was a part of what was so brilliant about Bowie was his ability to like an octopus, steal you know, one leg over here and one over there, and combine these things in new ways. And so, and I'm very similar in that I'm interested in all these different things. You know, I studied gypsy jazz at Berkeley, you know, Django Reinhardt. So you're bringing in, you know, gypsy folk music and different, you know, these elements and trying to find a way. And like Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, I was hugely obsessed with. So just the physical nature of physical storytelling. And so glam rock was just kind of a way to take all of these things that I love and sort of, yeah, put them in the music.
What about, so also that early 70s, Bowie, there's this sort of androgynous sort of aspect going on. Does that relate to yourself at all?
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, that was a huge part of my alienation in high school, was just centered around that I was, you know, pretty androgynous always as a kid growing up. And that was, you know, something, you know, Lisa, the Russian daughter, you know, she used to, we would like do photo shoots where, you know, we'd put on makeup and she would dress me and like she had all these fabulous clothes that I didn't have. And, you know, it was just kind of a part of like creating this other world and, you know, exploring that. And it was so close-minded where I grew up. It was so hyper-masculine, you know, and, yeah, so I think I struggled with that. And so when, you know, once I got out and was sort of, you know, on the path of like finding myself and expressing myself and rewriting songs and, you know, and, I was exploring that and, you know, that also, it just happens to fits in with the glam rock thing totally. And I think, you know, I think it's surprising that it still feels rebellious to, you know, to wear makeup in this day and age. I would have thought that it would have been become passe by now, but it's becoming more obvious every day that it's still, you know, it still is like, you know, you still get plenty of weird looks when I walk down the street, you know, wearing makeup and things. So, so I think it's still, you know, an important form of expression.
Well, let's talk some about the new album. So Here Comes a Good Part. I believe it's your fourth album.
It's my fourth release. Yes, but the first one was an EP. The second one was the self-released album, and then the first real album was Pronounced Jossie, which was the one where the record label took like half of the songs from my first self-release, and then some new ones, and sort of it's almost like a compilation record. So this really feels like my second proper record, but it's my fourth release. Yeah.
And this one's produced by Bobby Holland and yourself?
Yes.
Okay. So Bobby's there in Nashville.
Bobby's here in Nashville. Yeah. He's a brilliant, brilliant producer and mix engineer. Yeah.
And tell me something about him. So brilliant producer. Had he worked with you on the prior album, the Pronounced Jossie album, or how did you guys meet?
First record I produced and mixed all myself. We met actually at a 4th of July party, just through some mutual friends. And we just met. And I think we just kind of stood there and talked on the same spot for like 2 hours straight. So it was just kind of sort of like, you know, we just had a lot to talk about. He's you know, really intelligent. And we start talking about music and, you know, he's produced, I don't know if you're familiar with Maggie Rose, but he's done most of her, I think her last like 3 or 4 records in town. And he's done a lot of stuff more on the Americana side of things in Nashville, but he's done some pop records and some rock records. And it was kind of just like, we just really hit it off on a personal level. And he was like, yeah, come by the studio and, you know, let's do some stuff. It was very much like, you know, kind of just let's see if we can make something cool together, which, you know, I thought that was great. And he mixed Baby Blue, and, you know, I did a mix of that, and then I sent it to him and he did a mix of it, and it was, you know, 1,000 times better than what I could do. So it was like, it became apparent that, you know, he's really, really great. And then, yeah, we just started doing stuff together, and you know, he was I guess he really brings out, you know, whatever the artist's identity and what their vision is. You know, he's not a super like heavy hands-on, he's hands-on, but he's not heavy-handed as a producer. So it was great for me because I have a pretty good idea. I mean, I produced all my first stuff, so it was perfect for me because, you know, I had idea of where I was going, and he was just really helpful at, you know, taking it all the way and finishing it and getting it you know, which enabled me to do things that I wasn't able to do on my own, you know, like composing more on piano. And I mean, I wrote strings for this record, and we had, you know, brought in saxophone and kind of explored some other textures that I wanted to, but, you know, I didn't really have the resources to do in my bedroom.
Well, when did you start? Look, give me an idea. When did you start working on the album, and when was it completed?
I guess, I mean, I guess what happened was we were touring a lot in 2023, and I had Baby Blue, the song called 23, and I think Cheap High. I had three songs that are on this record that, you know, I had written, and we had released. I think we had just released Baby Blue at that point, but we were playing them in the live set, and they were, you know, working well in the live set. They were, you know, becoming a big part of it. And but, you know, every time I would come, we'd get off the road, it was like we were kind of on this weekend warrior schedule, where it was like, come home for a weekend, you know, you have a week off, and then you're back out on the road for like 5 dates, and then you come home. And that kind of transient on-off lifestyle is very hard to, it was very hard for me to get into like an album writing mode, you know, because that takes, you know, it's intense, you know. It's like, it's very different from like, you're kind of introverted when you're writing a record, and you're very super extroverted when you're performing. And those two personalities were, I was not able to switch them on and off back and forth like that. So nothing got done in 2023. And I was finally like, I had to tell my agents, like, you know, last year, it was just like, I can only tour a little bit. I need some big chunks, you know, some months, you know, at least a few months where I can just make this record. And so, yeah, basically last spring, I pretty much did, you know, aside from those three songs, I did the rest of the record then, and got in the studio with Bobby and just, you know, finished it out.
Our coolest song in the world this week is Cheap High, right? You mentioned this was one of the three that you had sort of been road testing before you focused on finishing off the rest of the album. So when did Cheap High come to you? Did you just pluck it out of the ether? Did it take longer to develop? What was the catalyst to Cheap High? What got that one written?
I remember I wanted an opening song. Like, I wanted a song where we could come out on stage and just like kick people in the face, you know, just like really something kind of fast and bombastic. And I also wanted to use ostinato, which is like a concept where each instrument enters, you know, like one after the other. So it was like the drums start, then the bass comes in, then the guitar, and then the vocals. And it kind of like starts in this kind of like stacked way. So I guess I had these like elements, you know, I'm always collecting these like musical elements that I want to use. And then, yeah, I just had that riff. And I remember we were just at rehearsal and I just started playing the riff, didn't really say anything anymore. I just started playing it and everybody kind of just jumped in. And, you know, we jammed it and I just felt it had energy immediately. And then I think we tried to record it, and it was like really slow. And it, you know, I think that was when I finished the lyrics, and like we finished the song, but the recording just didn't, it was really lackluster. It just didn't capture the energy. But we didn't really have time to re-record it. So we went on the road and we played it a bunch. And so we were like open with it. It was kind of our opening song for a while, a lot of the time, still is sometimes. And after playing, you know, we went on tour a bunch. And so then after 2023, when we went to, you know, finish this record, I was like, man, we really need to, you know, re-record that song. And we basically just did it. We literally came in the studio and did it exactly how we play it live, like pretty much all live on the floor. I mean, I think there was one guitar solo overdub and one vocal overdub, and that was it. So it's, you know, the recording is just literally, it was like, and we had just come off the road. So it was just, I think we did like three takes and that was it. And it finally, you know, that then it captured the energy we wanted.
So those other songs, there was Baby Blue, Cheap High. What was the third one that was sort of road tested before you went to the studio?
23.
That's it. 23. Okay. So those three. But now these other songs that, you know, you've taken on, you just cut back on the touring. What is there like is there a pattern or a routine that typically you use to sort of work up songs, or is each song wholly its own thing? Like inspiration comes from different ways and you wind up developing the song through different paths, or is there more of a routine?
There's, I guess, a little bit of both. I do have my, you know, most common ways of working, but I also purposefully, you know, try to approach things in different directions in order to not have everything sound the same. I mean, like, you know, like I was talking about with Cheap High, I mean, I'm always kind of generating riffs and things all the time, almost every day. I just, well, if I sit down on a guitar and pick it up, the first thing I play, I'll usually record, you know, a little something. And so sometimes if, you know, if I'm trying to write like, you know, band oriented, like rock songs, I'll get these riffs and then I'll just kind of have usually just a drummer or sometimes the whole band. I'm just, we'll kind of just jam on it and have it, you know, let it take, like, feel like, it, you know, everyone's, you know, have it. That'll usually kind of determine how, like, whether it, the idea, you know, works or not. It's like everybody jumps in and it's like, it feels good. Then there's something there. And then I'll usually like work on the song and the lyrics and the melody and on my own. And then kind of come back, like, you know, remember that idea we jammed on? Well, like, now it's a song. So that's a pretty common way. But, you know, with the piano stuff, you know, that on this record, that was more like me just writing on my own. You know, yeah, with acoustic songs, I usually just have to go off and, you know, it can take, you know, 30 minutes or a year to write a song. It kind of just depends. But I'm trying to get faster. I feel like I'm not the fastest for finish. I'm super fast at generating ideas and fast in the studio, but finishing like lyrics, and sometimes it can take a while. You gotta, you know, it's like that. And then it's gotta be right. So, you know, yeah, it can come, inspiration can come from many different directions. But I will say I don't usually do lyrics first, which is something I'm trying to do some for this record, is try lyrics first, because that's one I rarely do. I usually have melody and harmony first.
Mm. Well, tell me about the Snake City. You know, it gives me a very John D. Loudermilk kind of Tobacco Road vibe to Snake City.
I kind of that was a little intentional in like, I always, you know, I thought some of the best rock and roll riffs have come from blues riffs, you know. I mean, a lot, like how many more times Led Zeppelin, you know, it's like Howlin' Wolf riffs that they muscle them up a little bit. So I kind of wanted to take an old blues riff, so like that Lou Rawls Tobacco Road, and kind of, yeah, turn it like, what would, you know, like turn it into this glittery, you know, kind of more street-wise, edgier rock tune, but with roots in, you know, early blues music. So that was kind of intention there. And that song, actually, that song is interesting because I was researching Japanese kanji letters, and kanji letters is like through the Japanese writing, and there are these symbols that have a pronunciation, but they also have a meaning. Like each symbol has a meaning. And so there was a symbol that's pronounced ja, and it means snake. And there's another symbol that is pronounced shi, which means city. So you can write jashi, you can write my name in kanji letters, and it will mean snake city. So I thought that was really interesting. And I was like, man, if I could write a song to fit that. Yeah. So I wrote the song, and yeah. On the album insert, if you buy a record, a vinyl, those letters, the Japanese kanji letters, are in there. I never explained to anyone. I think the only people that will get that will be, you know, people that speak Japanese and can read it. But it's kind of just a little Easter egg in the album.
Very cool. Hey, another one of the tracks on the album, American Dream. How does the American Dream apply to you? Right. What is your American dream?
Yeah. Well, it's different for everybody. I feel like it's I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say these days. It's hard to say. It's kind of questionable, you know, where the American dream is headed at the moment, or if it's still around. But I think that was, you know, I mean, you know, there still is that idea of self-invention, self-creation that comes up a lot in my music, that I think, you know, ideally, hopefully in America, like, you can still do that. But at the path we're on, it may be something we have to fight for again. I don't know. But I think part of that song in particular, I came from kind of feeling that maybe the American dream was slipping away. And that was written, you know, that was before Trump was elected. So I was yeah, I think now it's even more relevant than it was when I actually wrote the song, because it was kind of just sort of, yeah, just feeling a little disillusioned with you know, America's ideals kind of fading away due to, I don't know if it's just due to the lack of, you know, people not remembering history or understanding, you know, where we came from, where, you know, how we've gotten to this point. I don't know. But yeah, so there was, you know, that was kind of, those were all kind of subconscious ideas in this song that sort of, you know, kind of form the underpinning of the lyrics. But they're more, you know, I'm not super direct in my writing. So that those kind of things are very beneath the surface, and they're there if you're looking for them. But they're also, you know, I don't come out right and say anything. So, but it was just that feeling of kind of feeling disillusioned with the American dream. But still, you know, there's still hope. There's still a hope that, you know, there's always kind of hope in it. And the song, you know, like, it happens over and over again. There's kind of such cyclical patterns that happen throughout time and throughout history. So, you know, there will be dark times and then there will be times of light. So it's like we're kind of in a dark time at the moment. But, you know, that's just where we find ourselves.
We're working towards the light.
Yes, always.
So what's cool to me too is okay. So you mentioned the three songs, and they were Baby Blue and Cheap High. So one of the ones I wanted to ask you about is 23. And when I first thought the title of the 23, and this relates back to somewhat of some of what you were talking about, the 23 is a conspiracy number, right? And the Illuminati, and so that Illuminati as a conspiracy seems to sort of be on the decline. There are plenty of other crazy conspiracies, I guess. But when I was actually listening to the tune, it was like, oh, chromosomes, genes, 23. That's where he's going with this. When did you come up with 23?
So this is very weird. And it's interesting. It's amazing that you asked me this question, because nobody's ever asked me this. And I've wanted to talk about it for years, and no one's ever asked me about 23. So thank you for asking that. 23 is one of the most bizarre things that's ever happened to me. And it's kind of the most proof that I have of kind of this connection to some kind of unknown divine something. I mean, there's something, this number. So when I was at Berkeley in my second year, I remember just like waking up, and I would wake up every day and it would be like 10:23 a.m. And then like later in the day, it just kind of happened one day, like it was 10:23. And then later in the day, it's like 4:23. And then the next morning, it's like 9:23. And then, you know, later that day, and then it would be like, oh, I need to go. Oh, what time is it? I remember one time, like, you know, my phone was dead, and I was like, oh, I don't have a way to tell time. And I would ask someone, hey, excuse me, what time is it? They're like, oh, it's 5:23. It's like this number just started showing up. It just happened one day. And then I was dating a girl. Her birthday was the 23rd of July. At that time, and then I remember I was traveling and I met someone, and their address was 23 this Grove Street, and it was just like it just started happening all the time, over and over, and I was just like observing it. I had no attachment to it, and I was just kind of observing and trying to figure out why is this number following me. And I remember one day, you know, I went to the beach, and I was driving behind this big truck, and it just said 23 on the back. When all this was going on, I kind of just started noticing this. And I got to the beach and I was like, I had this Maya calendar necklace. And I remember being like, this kind of started happening when I started wearing this necklace. So I remember it had these little boxes, you know, the Maya calendar has all these little compartments that go around. It's in this ring. And I counted them, and there were 23 of them. And it was just like, oh, there it is again. And then I remember 23 people happened to come to my 23rd birthday party, which was a show. I played a show. It was kind of like a house show, and there were 23 people there. And it was just like, and then it just started. I mean, there were so many, like I had a major injury. I injured my hand on March 23rd. I injured it a second time on like a January 23rd. I had all of the, I mean, it just became this, it became literally a beat. Like a life beat, where anytime anything would happen, whether it was good, I couldn't tell if it was good or bad. It was kind of anytime anything would change. Like I would be at a party every time, anytime I'm anywhere, and I'm just, you know, you're having a conversation, you're kind of like, I think I'm about ready to leave. And then that moment where you're like, okay, now's my chance. Like, now I'm going to leave. And you step out the door and you look at your, you know, look at the phone. Oh, what time is it? And it just happens to be points. Like, it just has this weird I don't know what it is. It's just kind of a connection that I have to this number.
So are you familiar with the author, Robert Anton Wilson?
I'm not, but I know William F. Burroughs.
So you could look that. He's got a whole thing about the number 23, 2 and 3, principle of fives. And basically, I'll let you look that up. It's been a long time since I've thought about that, but that ties back into, this sort of Illuminati and conspiracy stuff. And so you have to be careful with that. But yes, it's a principle of fives.
I don't know what it is. It's just, I have a connection to this number. I mean, like on the album cover of Ziggy Stardust, I remember, you can't see it on the actual album cover, but there's outtake from that photo shoot. And in the outtake, he's standing, the number, you can just barely see the 2 and the 3 on the actual album cover. It's above his head, but he's standing at 23 Hedden Street. That's the address where he's standing on that album cover. Which I thought, yeah, was another, you know, it's just fascinating to see how this number has just kind of been, in my life for whatever reason. It still is on a very regular basis. And it's just kind of, I just at this point. So anyway, that song, I wanted to write a song where I wanted to incorporate that number in a song because it was just around me all the time and it means something. I don't know what it means, but it's there. And so I pay attention to it. And it's just kind of, at this point, it's kind of just like an old friend. It's just something that follows me around and I have no idea why. But William S. Burroughs had a thing about it. I know he wrote about seeing it a lot. But there's not a whole lot. I mean, there's not a whole lot. It's probably 23 Enigma. I know there was that weird movie about it, which is funny. I don't know. Anyway, but I always thought it was very fascinating and just kind of this weird connecting I don't look for it. It just goes up all the time. And I'm kind of just like, I don't know.
It's 23 and me.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then it's 23 chromosomes. Yeah. I mean, I think it is. It does have some, there's some mystical power in that number, I think. But
hey, so you mentioned about cutting back on touring when, you know, you had to focus on finishing off the rest of the album. Do you have any upcoming gigs now?
We're working on gigs now. We were working on a European tour in September/October. And then we've got pending dates in May and June. So
okay,
May and June this year in the U.S. we'll be touring. I don't think we're going to do much aside from that, unless, you know, maybe some like festivals or kind of one-off offers. But I kind of want to avoid, similarly, you know, like I did last year, I don't want to be on the road kind of like sporadically all year, because I'm already working on the next record. I've got like 4 songs into the next record and I'm trying to get that done this spring, just to keep the momentum going and keep rolling, keep the juices flowing creatively and not just, you know, be on the road a bunch and then have another year go by before I put out another record. So.
Well, all right. Well, we can hear another song off the current album, the new album, Here Comes a Good Part. And I want us to take a listen to the opening track, Sweet Thing. And the chorus repeats the lyric, "It's a sweet thing, oh baby, when you get to be who you really are." So are you experiencing that sweet thing? Have you gotten to be who you really are?
Yeah. Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, it's always, you're always working on it. But yeah, I mean, at least I'm on the path, you know, and I think part of that is making records, you know, the process of making a record and expressing myself in different ways is kind of part of walking the path of you know, becoming who you are. But yeah, I mean, that, you know, I felt so afraid, you know, I spent many years in fear of being who I was because I was in a place where I wasn't free to be who I really was. So, and I think a lot of people, you know, all over the world and in this country that have similar experiences, you know, you know, I just, you know, anybody different, all different, or, you know, especially the queer community and the trans community, you know, those kids all over the country that are living in fear. And I think it's that path, my own path of overcoming that and, you know, inventing / discovering / exploring my own self, I think resonates. I see that in other people, and I'm inspired by, you know, what I went through, but also hugely inspired by, you know, the kids I see going through that, and the stories of these characters, you know, like that move out of these small towns and go to the city and reinvent themselves and express themselves. And, you know, I think it's a sweet thing.
And Jossie, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, we're going to give a listen now, opening track to Here Comes the Good Part, It's Sweet Thing, in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was some of his song, Sweet Thing, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The tune is off the glam rocker's latest album, Here Comes the Good Part. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Jossie for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing and editing our podcast. UK singer-songwriter Courtney Hadwin, she's got a new single out called Spellbound, co-written with her producer and Underground Garage favorite, Kevin Bowe. She first came to prominence with an appearance on America's Got Talent, and in 2023, her single Monsters was voted to be the coolest song of the year. That's Courtney Hadwin, my guest next time around on our Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy.
Make a big noise playing in the street.
I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.